Yeah, my name is Sherry Jones, and I'm author of Josephine Baker's Last Dance.
Okay. Let's talk about just a little bit about your background. I mean, this is obviously not your first book. You've been writing for a while, and how many other books have you written?
Josephine Baker's Last Dance is my fifth full-length novel, and then I also have written an e-novella called White Heart that was set in the 1200s.
And so, what's the story in this other, the kind of controversial one? Did that get published, or what?
Yeah.
What's the kind of a brief thumbnail?
My first novel was The Jewel of Medina, about the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad. Her name was Aisha, and she was his favorite wife. And so I wanted to write a novel that humanizes Islam and the founders of Islam and tells the story of this amazing woman. And so that book was supposed to be published in August of 2008 by Random House, but then just a few months before publication, they got a call from a professor at the University of Texas in Austin who didn't like the book and said that they would be attacked by terrorists if they published it. So essentially, Random House backed out of publishing the book in late May of 2008. And so then we had to scramble to find another publisher. And because the story of what happened made it into the Wall Street Journal and it went viral around the world, there were a number of publishers then who were interested, but everyone had someone on the editorial team who was afraid that Random House was right and they would be attacked. Mm-hmm. So we ended up going with a tiny publisher in the United States called Beaufort Books. And their fame at the time was they published O.J. Simpson's book, If I Did It. We also had a British publisher called Gibson Square, and they were the first ones to come out to offer to publish The Jewel of Medina. And then shortly before the month they were supposed to publish, they got attacked by some Muslim men, dropped a letter, a Molotov cocktail in the letter slot of the Home Office at Gibson Square. So Scotland Yard was on the scene. They already had been following these guys, and they arrested them instantly. But the publisher went into hiding, and shortly thereafter, he dropped publication.
Wow. So it never did get published then?
Not in the UK, but in the United States, Beaufort Books did come out with the book in October of 2008.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And nothing ever happened to them, or there was never any kind of repercussions for those
folks? No. And my book was published in 19 languages around the world, and I did a number of book tours with bodyguards and everything, but nothing ever happened. You know, one of the most exciting things that happened was that the FBI in Spokane got involved and started monitoring and met with me and told me they were worried about my safety, which, you know, caused me to dissolve in tears as soon as they drove away. But nothing ever happened. So I think that the publication of the book really stopped anything bad from happening, because my book is very respectful to Islam and to its founding members.
Okay, because the attack occurred before the book had been published. Anybody had a chance to really see what was in there.
That's right. Yeah, it's like I said at the time, and I still think so. The non-published book was like, you know, a mirror or a blank slate for people to project their own hopes and fears, and mostly fears, onto. So once the book was published, people could see that it was not what it had been characterized as being, which was the concern of Denise Spellberg in Austin, was that I had portrayed the wives of the Prophet as being in sexual competition for him, which of course they were. And she thought that characterization would cause anger among the extremists in the Muslim community.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now this new one, how did you kind of hit on her, Josephine Baker as a subject to begin with? How did she appeal to you, or where'd that come from?
Well, I was kind of tired of writing about the Middle Ages, and I wanted to move into the 20th century and do something more contemporary. Also, my previous book, The Sharp Hook of Love, had been about Abelard and Heloise, who were famous scholars and lovers in the Middle Ages in Paris, and it's a very tragic tale. I cried while I was writing it. People cried while they read it. And I wanted something more lighthearted and fun. And I had always admired Josephine Baker, although I didn't know much about her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she'd made cameo appearances in several movies that I'd seen, and I was curious about who she was, and I had looked her up already and knew some things about her. And so I thought it would be just this lighthearted romp, you know, a fun story about this you know, African-American woman who made it big in Paris dancing topless and wearing a skirt made of bananas.
Right.
But as I started researching, I came to see that Josephine Baker's life in her early years was incredibly difficult. She grew up in St. Louis, and she was in an abusive household. She grew up in extreme poverty, and she witnessed the most atrocious acts of racism as a child. With the East St. Louis riots of 1917, she was 11 at the time. So that colored her, literally and figuratively colored her entire life. And as time went on, she became more and more outspoken against and an activist against racism. And so my book really became about that, a book about race, which was so interesting to me as a white woman to learn about the Black experience and to really develop that empathy.
How much research did you have to do on her? You're doing kind of this biographical novel where obviously you're filling in some unknown gaps, but
right.
Did you spend quite a lot of time reading biographies and
Oh, yes.
Research?
I read everything I could get my hands on. There are maybe 10 or 12 biographies of Josephine Baker, and I read them all, every one I could find. And I also read books about the era in which she lived. You know, I listened to all the music of the time that I could find, you know, from the 1900s on. And I also learned about Black vaudeville, which she was a part of starting at age 13. I learned about the 1920s jazz age in America and in Paris. I learned about the Harlem Renaissance because she lived in Harlem in New York for a while as a young woman.
Before she went to
Yes.
Or,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, you know, I brushed up on my French. I went to Paris a couple of times. I went to New York and researched New York jazz scene and the history of that.
So when you were in Paris, how did you do your research there? I mean, I'm guessing they have maybe some museums or information, but were you able to interview some other folks that maybe either had written about her or had actually known her? Because I'm not quite sure when she died, for example, but...
No, she died in 1974.
Okay.
And when she was 68, almost 69 years old. And no, I was not able to. You know, I was going to interview her oldest adopted son, Jean-Claude Baker, who wrote the first biography of Josephine Baker that I had read. I didn't care for the biography a lot because I felt that it clearly showed that he had some kind of agenda, you know. He had a very troubled relationship with her in her last years of life, and I think that shows through. He was pretty derisive and mocking in certain places in the book, too, but he really did his homework, and he had the address of every place she'd ever lived, and, you know, he knew her for many years. He didn't know her in her early years. He met her later when she was a little older, but... He and I talked on the phone. He called me from Paris after I had written to him telling him I was working on this book. And he said I had his full support. We arranged to try to meet in New York the following winter. And then he died. So I didn't get to meet with him.
Oh.
And by then, none of her other children, I guess they were, I don't know, I couldn't find them. I couldn't track them down.
Okay.
So.
But you had a few phone conversations to get a little bit of data and.
Yes, and people who, I have a Facebook friend who is a fan of mine who loves Josephine Baker's Last Dance, and he knew Josephine Baker. His mother was very close friends with her. He lives in Sweden, and he says my book is right on.
Okay.
So
you had all the biographical basic data, you know, when she was in certain locales, and that's the next part I'm going to get to, because I primarily just know her as kind of the dancer part. But I knew that she had something to do with civil rights, so I'm just going to ask you about the various things she did. But you had to fill in kind of these gaps, too, so that's
yes.
kind of different. You're, it's those, what do you call them, the novel. It's kind of a historical novel.
Yes, it is, biographical fiction. And and so there's a lot about, you know, anyone who was alive at one point and isn't anymore that we don't know. With Josephine Baker, it was especially challenging because she was the ultimate unreliable narrator about her own life.
Oh.
You know, in fiction, an unreliable narrator is someone who's telling the story, but you don't know whether to believe them,
mm-hmm.
their point of view, or what they say.
So she had kind of made up of her own personal history?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
She made up a lot of things.
Yeah.
So, and she changed her story frequently. depending on who she was talking to or the mood she was in or what she thought would sound good at the time. So, you know, we don't really know who her father was. And in her story, at various times, her father was, you know, a Spanish guitarist, a Jewish man, a white man, etc.
Wow. Okay. So, that kind of reminds me of Bob Dylan.
Oh, yeah. Did he do that?
Same thing with his story. He told everybody, you know, he's a little kid from Minnesota. And when he got to New York, he told them he had joined the circus like at age 13, grown up in the circus. And all this stuff got printed in Billboard as though it was fact.
Oh, yeah. Well,
same kind of thing.
Yeah. How do you check up on that stuff?
So, okay. So she starts out in the USA and does she immediately, is her first big deal being a dancer? And then she goes to Europe? Is that kind of the timeline?
Yeah.
You don't have to give me all the minutiae,
but
is that kind of what happened?
Well, yeah, she was discovered playing music and dancing on the streets of St. Louis, where she grew up, on Market Street, which was where Scott Joplin was playing and all these other great musicians at the time. St. Louis was kind of the center of the cultural universe in many ways for the blues and jazz in the United States. And so she was sort of discovered that way, but she also, there was a black theater in her town, St. Louis, called the Booker T. Washington Theater. Huh. And she hung out there. She was entranced by the theater. She loved the animal acts, the female impersonators, the women, the glamorous black women singers with their feather boas and their bright orange lipstick and purple hair. And she hung out there. She skipped school. She got in trouble a lot for playing hooky from school and going to hang out at the Booker T. And so ultimately, she befriended, you know, the different performers, and they started bringing her backstage to help with the animal acts or to help them get dressed. And over time, she got hired there to do that. And then she got cast in her first show. And that was when she was 13.
Wow.
And so she went on the road with this touring company.
As a dancer?
Yeah, she was dancing in the chorus. Dancing in the chorus. Her first act was she played Cupid in this skit, and she was strung up by a wire, and she flew back and forth across the stage in these wings and this outfit. And so in my book, there's a funny story about how, you know, her first time actually doing this, the wire got tangled up in the curtain, one of the backdrop curtains, and there was this ripping sound, and, you know, she was careening wildly back and forth across the stage in the air, and she was frightened, but she looked down, she saw that everybody was quiet, and she started making funny faces and hamming it up, and people started laughing. So she was a great comedian.
Okay.
And her role in the chorus as a dancer was always the end dancer. They're the one who comes on last, and they trip as they come on, and they do all these comic gigs, gags. Okay. I mean, when she was, you know, when they dance. And so that was her role. She was very popular as a comedian.
Okay. Yeah. So did she get real popular in the U.S. and then went to Europe, like after World War II, or what did she get to Europe exactly?
Well, Josephine Baker did land a job when she was 16 as a chorus dancer with Shuffle Along, which was the first off-Broadway African-American revue. And so she got a job doing that, but she was never really famous in the United States. After Shuffle Along closed, she started another show, also by Sissel and Blake. They were this famous musical writing duo. And then after that closed, she went to work on Broadway in the Winter Gardens, the Plantation Room of the Winter Gardens Theater, as a chorus dancer. She always wanted to sing. Mm-hmm. She just idolized those women, Clara Smith and, you know, all these famous singers at the time. And so she never had a voice that people liked, and so she couldn't get a gig as a singer, but she was discovered as a dancer at the Plantation Gardens, and by this woman named Caroline Dudley Reagan, who was a white woman, who an entrepreneur, and one was putting together a black revue for the Paris stage. So
okay.
She was looking
for people to take to Europe then?
Yes, she was. Okay. Yes. And so She saw Josephine dance, and she recruited her to join the troupe. And as the star dancer, Josephine wanted to be a singer, and this could never get anyone to let her do it. So she went with the dancing, and when she got into Paris, they had the show all choreographed, and they had all the members of the show there, and the French theater manager at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, he hated the show and said that it's got too much tap dancing, everybody's skin color is too light. French people hate tap dancing, and they want dark-skinned. They like the exotic, you know, aspect of black people. So he brought in a Nigerian dark-skinned dancer, and he also didn't like the fact there was no nudity in the show. It was a big tradition of the Paris dance halls. And so
it already was.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. So
interesting.
But no black woman had ever danced nude. It wasn't really nude, but they call it that in France. Mm-hmm. No black woman had ever danced nude. And so they wanted Josephine Baker to dance nude. And at first she said no. She cried. She said, "I'm not a stripper." You know, she was religious. She didn't want God to strike her dead. She was afraid. But she was pretty much coerced into doing it, told that they wouldn't send her home on the ship unless she opened the show.
Okay.
And so she performed this wild, exotic, erotic dance with this Nigerian dancer. They had people leaping up from their seats and running for the exits. The Théâtre des Champs-Élysées has a long history of that. They also premiered The Rites of Spring.
This is what I was thinking of.
Yes, okay. Right, which was also, you know,
caused
people to run out the theater. So.
But running out, but they're excited about it. They weren't. It wasn't scandalous, was it? It was more
It was scandalous.
And over-the-top exciting.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so that performance.
What year was that?
That was 1925.
Okay, so post-war.
Yes, post World War I.
She's a total sensation because of this, right? Like kind of an overnight sensation.
Yes, she was. Yep, and she never looked back. You know, she embraced nudity, and she left on a tour with La Revue Negra, the review she was in. But then she came back before the tour was over. She had an offer to headline at the Folie Bergère, and she took it. And she danced to the famous banana skirt in that show. And just became this huge, iconic sensation. But then, after a couple of years of doing this, she left Paris. She went on tour, and she learned while she was gone for about 3 years. She trained as a singer, and she also learned to speak French. And when she came back, she had completely reinvented herself.
Oh, and that's her first kind of reinvention, right?
Yes, okay. Yes. So she was always remaking herself, yeah.
Was she a sensation as a singer,
she
too?
She was,
then?
Yes. She was worried that she wouldn't be accepted. They still wanted the nudity and the banana skirt, but she was embraced as a singer. And the shows that she was in were spectacular. You know, she had all these different costume changes with these elaborate outfits. And she did some dancing, she did some singing, but she put the banana skirt away. After that.
So now what era? Are we into the 30s yet or no?
Late 20s. She also opened her own nightclub in Paris called Chez Josephine, which was hugely successful. And there she did more risque kinds of dances and things. So, in the 1930s, she continued with her popularity, but then she did another tour, and she went back to Berlin, where she had gone in the 20s, and was very popular there. But the scene had changed. Nazi brown shirts were everywhere. There was a lot of racism, a lot of frightening moments for Josephine Baker, and it culminated with her dancing on the stage and seeing a Nazi soldier in the front row fondling a pistol in his lap. And a big gun. And so she went off stage after she did her act, and she slipped out the back and got on the train and never went back
and
to Berlin.
Did she go back to Paris then?
Yes,
okay.
She did.
Wow. So she had already been to Berlin kind of in the 20s when Berlin was this decadent kind of kind of scene with the whole scene there was like really risque and over the top. And
it was even more so than in Paris.
Yeah, right.
And so she hung out with, Max Weinhardt, the famous director who encouraged her to study with him, and he would make of her a great comic actress. But Josephine Baker, she considered doing that, but she really loved the stage and live theater. And once she went onto a movie set and saw all the standing around there is, that happens, and she just decided that she would be too bored doing
that. She didn't want to do film at all.
Well, she did do film, actually.
Okay.
She ended up making at least three films in Paris, three that, you know, we have today. And she was a star. She was the first Black woman to star in a feature film. And her first film, La Sirène de Tropique, was a silent film. And then she did two talkies.
Okay.
And she always wanted to, you know, come to Hollywood and hit it big, you know, in her own country. But that never really worked out for her.
Okay, so now we're into the 30s. Is this the time frame where she's operating as a spy then?
Yeah, she had gotten her pilot's license and was flying for the Red Cross. And she also was working with an anti-racism organization. I think that her experiences, you know, not only in Germany, but touring the world at that time in the 30s, I think she was really, she was exposed to a lot of racism in various countries. You know, a lot of people, wherever she went, she was loved, but there was also this racial undertones. And so it really made a mark on her. And also in 1934, she came to the United States. She was dubious about whether she should or not, but she came, she was coaxed into it. She was lured by the opportunity to perhaps make a difference for women of color. She was got a gig starring in the Ziegfeld Follies. She was the first Black woman to headline there, but she wasn't the main headliner, and that was upsetting for her. Fanny Bryce, who was much more well-known and very popular, was the headliner. And according to everything I've read, Fanny Bryce was quite racist against Josephine Baker and quite cruel to her. And so those experiences, you know, really gave Josephine Baker even more determination to, you know, fight back against racism. So she was approached by a captain with the French military in the intelligence services to help him get information and transfer it, take it across borders. And so she embraced that, and she did that. She would go to parties and meet German generals or, you know, and she would get them to divulge their secrets, and then she would write everything down in invisible ink on her sheet music or on pieces of paper that she would safety pin to her underwear. Or sometimes I read that she had written information on the inside of her arms and wore long sleeves, and she went across borders supposedly on tour.
So she was going maybe even into Germany and such, or?
No, she wasn't going into Germany. Okay. She did most of her spy work in Paris and then also in Lisbon. She was headquartered in Lisbon for a while.
Okay.
Also in Marseille. These were places where a lot of people, you know, Marseille was a port city, so was Lisbon.
Sure.
So she did a lot of spy work for Charles de Gaulle.
Okay.
You know, doing that.
That just reminded me of the Bogart movie. What is it? You know, that classic one with Rick's place.
Oh, right.
And there's
Casablanca.
All this intrigue.
Yeah.
Yeah. All these Nazis and stuff.
Right, they yes. And it was the same for her.
Yeah.
And Chez Josephine, they had, you know, when the Nazis took over Paris, they hung out in her club.
So, yeah, that's the other thing I was going to say. Did she flee Paris when the war started? Was she still? Did she stay there?
She left pretty soon after the city was invaded. She saw that she was in trouble as a Black woman. But she did keep Chez Josephine open at first. It was a good way to get information. You know, and but she never had music there. She said that there would be no music in her club as long as the Nazis occupied Paris. So she never performed or entertained the Germans. And she was actually very proud of that.
So did she then flee and come back to the U.S.?
Is that she fled and went to South Central France or Southeastern France, where her her castle. She owned a castle called Les Malandes, and so she lived there, and she did she and the other spies, the other members of the Maquis or the French Resistance would gather there. She got searched. Her castle was suddenly searched, even though they were in the free zone.
Vichy,
yes,
France.
But
okay.
The Nazis showed up to search her castle, and she had people hiding in the basement, but she was able to allay the suspicions of the Nazis. And when they left, Jacques Atté, the captain that she'd been working with, said to her, "We're getting out of here today." And so they left. And they got their orders from de Gaulle, and they went to Marseille, and then they ended up going to Lisbon and staying there. And then she spent some of the time in Morocco. She went there to work with de Gaulle's people there. But
wow.
She came down with a terrible illness and was hospitalized for a year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah.
So after the war, what does she do? Does she return to France, or does she eventually make her way back?
Yeah, she did return to France. She was made an honorary member of the French Free Air Force, Women's Auxiliary.
Because you said she was a pilot.
Yeah, she had been a pilot, and she did do some flying for the resistance also. One of the stories I love about Josephine Baker is that, you know, she'd been in the hospital. She'd have to have several surgeries, and she was pretty sick, but then when the Allied forces came into, I believe it was Marrakesh, where she was, in Morocco, they had defeated, I think the Italians to get to land, and the American troops came down the street in victory, and Josephine Baker got out of bed and said, "Help me get dressed. I've got to go down and greet the troops." And she went down and started entertaining the troops.
Were they aware
right
of who
away.
She was?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They knew who she was.
Yeah.
She was a pretty big star.
Yeah, she was
anyway.
A big star. Yes.
Yeah, in other words, she's in France and she's a superstar, but back in America, people are still aware of who she is, right?
Or they knew who she was.
Okay.
She was not as acclaimed or popular, largely, I think, because of her race. When she performed in the Ziegfeld Follies, she was criticized heavily by the press for, they said she didn't have a big enough voice when she sang, or, they didn't like some of the routines that she did. There was one routine that she did. She was supposed to dance with these white men, and she was wearing this heavy gold gown, and they were supposed to lift her up during the dance, and it was scandalous to people, so they had to cut that part of the dance. In her nightclub, however, Chez Josephine was hugely popular. The critics loved her there, and she did that dance with the white men in her club, and nobody cared. You did ask me why, I wrote about her. Well, like I said, I wanted something fun and frolicky and frivolous, and and then I discovered that her life had a lot of very serious material and really serious undertones. And it turned out, to be something much different than I had expected, this book. But she was so inspiring. I spent 4 years working on this book. And what kept me going was the inspiration that was Josephine Baker, because in spite of, all her obstacles in her life, she prevailed. She did all the things that she wanted to do in life. She dared to dream big, and she made things happen for herself. Mm-hmm. And at some point, and I think it was during her time as a spy, she really saw that she could make a difference. That, one person, one woman, she could really make a difference. And so she, after World War II was over and Paris and France were independent again, she came back to the United States to do a tour. Once again, she was reluctant because of racism. In 1934, when she was here with the Ziegfeld Follies, she couldn't get into a white hotel.
Yeah.
She couldn't eat in a lot of the restaurants. Everything was segregated. And so she was recruited to perform in Miami at a nightclub, and she told the owner she wouldn't perform there unless he integrated the audiences, which had never been done there before. And he agreed, and they even flew some people in, people of color in, to include in the audience. And there was no trouble. It was, they the other nightclubs in Miami saw that they were succeeding, and they started integrating too. And so
and
she.
What year is this around?
This was 1951.
Okay. Wow.
And she had publicly proclaimed at a press conference that she would not perform in any theater that was segregated. She wouldn't dine in any restaurant that was segregated. She wouldn't stay in a city that segregated its hotels. And she stayed true to that, and she got a lot of places integrated for the first time in 1951.
Well, that's amazing. I never heard that part of the story at all.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big deal in 1951, because remember, like, the stories about, like, in Las Vegas in the late 50s of the Rat Pack guys trying to bring Sammy Davis Jr. into those hotels, and I think they freaked out on that then.
Yes, I'm sure they
even
did.
Even with the connection with those, you know, the mob guys and the Rat Pack, you know, Dean Martin types and stuff.
Yeah, and it wasn't just in New York. It was everywhere. I've heard that, who was it, Louis Armstrong, I think, or Duke Ellington, who wanted to stay in the Davenport Hotel.
I think it's Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so it was everywhere. And
oh, man.
It's hard to imagine what that must feel like, you know, as a white person to be shut out because of the color of your skin as though you're somehow less than or... You know,
especially if you're a big star like those people were, you know, they're in the newspapers and everybody knows who you are. And yet, well, you know, you can't stay in our hotel.
Yeah, she was treated as an equal in Paris. They didn't have those hangups there. And so, I love the scene in my book where dress rehearsal at La Revue Negra, her first show, they put up this long table on the stage after the performance and they sat everybody together. White people and black people, and she was astonished that she was eating at the same table with white people.
Yeah, and that's sort of like parallel to all those GIs, well, not even the GIs, but the doughboys from World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Black doughboys go over there. Then they come back here, and they're just treated like crap again.
Same thing
with the World War II guys coming back, and they come back to segregated communities, you know, and they were all over there in France, where they're welcomed with open arms.
They were heroes
during
World War I, the black regiments. And, you know, one of the most shocking things that I discovered, stories I found in my research, was that after the war was over, the French government offered all the soldiers who had fought with the French forces a free French education, college education. And the U.S. government didn't tell the black soldiers until they got back to the States. But they told the white soldiers. So I think I read that only 13 black soldiers actually were able to take advantage of this offer.
Now, were these guys that were actually in the American army, or were they were in the French army? Or
they were the American military, but U.S. military didn't know what to do with them because they didn't integrate. They didn't want to integrate.
Right.
So they sent them
right
to France where it was integrated.
Okay.
And they fought with the French forces.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And they didn't even tell them until they got back.
Yeah. Isn't that shocking? I mean, it's just disgusting.
Great.
Yeah.
So what is, you know, the final part of this is she lives until what year does she live?
She lived until 1974.
What's kind of the synopsis of what happened? You know, what did she do with her life besides this kind of, you know, civil rights kind of stuff in the 50s? What else does she do?
Well, she adopted 12 children from around the world. Mm. She wanted to have children, was never able to bear any children. And so she adopted 12 babies from around the world, mostly boys, different cultures, different races, on purpose. She called it her rainbow tribe. She was like Angelina Jolie, you know, of her day. And she wanted to show the world that racism and hatred are not something that we are inherently, you know, born with, but that it's taught. And her children grew up together. And from what I've read, they grew up, you know, a very close-knit group. She wanted to stay home and be with those children. She married. But she, the castle and 12 children were incredibly expensive.
Now, the castle, we're talking about in the U.S.?
No, in France. She stayed in France. Yeah, she stayed. She didn't stay long. In 1951, she did a sit-in at a restaurant called the Stork Club, a very elite whites-only restaurant. She went in to get served, and they didn't serve her.
Is that in Florida, too?
It was in New York City.
Okay, I've heard of
it. Yeah, so she made a big fuss over that with the NAACP. She accused Walter Winchell, the great journalist who was there at the time of seeing it and doing nothing. Huh. And he got very offended, and his friend was J. Edgar Hoover, and they started smearing her as a communist sympathizer, which was not true at all. But she was basically, she left the United States to tour, and she was told not to come back.
Oh, boy.
She was basically banished.
So sort of like the Charlie Chaplin thing, where I think Hoover had him targeted too as a communist, and I don't know what the background, but you know,
yeah, anybody
Hoover,
who
in that
was
era, they did that with a lot of people.
Yeah, anybody who was liberal, and you know, for a number of black people, you know, I've read about several W.E.B. Du Bois, I think it was, and you know, other famous black people who had their passports revoked. So they couldn't leave the country because the U.S. government didn't want them going abroad and talking about racism in the United States. It was being used against the United States by the Soviet Union as propaganda.
Sure.
And so they were shown, they were accusing them of being communist sympathizers.
So did she ever come back?
Yeah, she did. She came back in 1963. She was invited to come back and speak at the March on Washington with Martin Luther King Jr. She was the only woman who spoke. She gave a very uplifting and inspiring speech. And she spoke right before Dr. King did.
Oh, wow. Okay. Boy, I'm glad I asked you that part.
Yeah.
Is that kind of... And then what's the end of her story? I mean...
Well, she basically was penniless. You know, when she died, she lost her castle. She... The 1951 activities, she was warned by her agent and others that if she took these stances that she would lose gigs. And indeed, when J. Edgar Hoover got involved and she started getting accused of being a communist sympathizer, especially, she started losing gigs. And there was a... Hemingway was working on a screenplay for a movie she was going to star in. That got canned. She lost a bunch of bookings. She ended up just going back to France after that. And staying in France until 63. But she lost, because of all the economic opportunities she lost, she couldn't sustain her castle and her family. So, and her marriage ended. And so she ended up losing her castle, getting evicted. It's a very sad story. There's a famous photo of her on the back step of her castle in her robe, nightgown, and, you know, shower cap, surrounded by cats and cans of food. I mean, it's very sad. Mm. And Princess Grace of Monaco, who had been the famous actress Grace Kelly, she had befriended Josephine Baker and gave her a house, arranged for her to get a house to live in and with her children. And so she spent the rest of her life touring, doing comebacks. Josephine Baker's last dance is structured around her very last show at the Bobino Theater, in which she did a review of 50 years on the Paris stage.
Oh.
And so it basically went through.
Thing online, but as you know, I'll probably
yeah.
not have a whole bunch in the story. But let's see. I was going to ask, you know, what's next for you? I mean, as far as writing goes, and are you doing another tour about your book? I mean, you just got back. You were in New York and you did some interviews there about the book.
I did some interviews. I did a reading at Lady Jane's Salon, which is a writer's salon that did meet every other month in New York. It's my third time reading with them from my books. And and I did an interview on BBC Radio about my first book, The Jewel of Medina. And so then I came back. I met with my publisher, you know, my editor there, and we had lunch at Chez Josephine, the restaurant that's dedicated to Josephine Baker, everything Josephine Baker in that place. So,
oh, wow.
And so, you know, I don't really know what I'm going to be working on yet. I have an idea for another biographical novel that I'm really excited about, but I'm also considering doing something that's not biographical fiction. So,
but you haven't picked a subject yet for the possible
not
one.
Definitively, although I have a really good biographical fiction idea. Huh. So
don't want to share that with us probably.
No, or... I want to wait till I decide, but
yeah,
it would be set in New York City. So it's about a writer who lived in New York.
What era?
So through the 1920s again, that era. And you know, I want to tell you also that one of my favorite scenes from Josephine Baker's life occurs on the last night she was alive.
Oh yeah.
She had performed the night before with, you know, the grand opening of her last show called Josephine a Bobbino. And you know, Mick Jagger was there, Princess Grace, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, all these great stars. The next night, she performed just a regular show. And then she went out afterwards with the cast to this cafe and was trying to get everyone to go out. And people are like, Josephine, you kept us up till 4 a.m. You know, last night, we're tired. And she was definitely a night owl. And so, you know, 2 a.m, Josephine Baker was dancing on the table in this cafe, shouting, I'm 17, I'm 17. And that night, someone gave her a ride home, and she went into her apartment, and she got out the clips of the reviews of her show and had them spread on the bed around her. And she had an aneurysm right there in the bed, looking at the reviews of her show. And that's how basically they found her.
Oh, wow. So she was alone when that happened at the very end.
Or there was someone living in the apartment with her, but she was alone in her room when that happened. Yeah, they took her to the hospital, and she died in the hospital.
What year was that?
1974. It was April of 1974.
Wow, so she really lived a long, full life.
Yeah, she lived to almost age 69, which is amazing considering all the health problems she had. Heart problems, and she had this, you know, complications after having pneumonia. When she was sick in Morocco, she got perionitis.
I
think that's what it's called.
Yeah.
And which is a blood poison, basically, blood poisoning. And she had to have a hysterectomy and, you know, very, very lots of health problems throughout her life. So that she lived as long as she did was pretty amazing.
Wow.
And dancing till the very end.
The very end.
Yeah, my book opens with an epigraph where she says, I'd love to die dancing, breathless, at the end of a dance. Oh. And she did.
Oh, how perfect is that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what else would I need to know about this? Because what I'll do is I jotted a couple notes down. I like the spot. There was a spot at the beginning of the second tape. I can't remember what you were saying, but it was kind of a why you were interested in her. I thought that was the most fascinating. But
yeah.
I think
but she's one of the most charismatic, successful people, black or white or any color, any gender, whoever lived. And she'll be a hard act to follow. I mean, when I say I don't know what I'm going to write about next, you know, that's part of it, is that who could follow Josephine Baker? Princess Grace told her on opening night of her show, you know, you need a movie or a novel. And Josephine Baker's response was, who would dare?
A novel about her? You mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I did.
Okay.
Awesome. I dared. But I don't know who's going to follow her.
How is this book doing, though? I mean, it's kind of hard to tell. When was it public? When did it come out? Like,
it just came out December 4th.
The 4th. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's only
like a week and a half ago.
Can you tell already at all about, I mean, I know you got a lot of reviews.
I've gotten some really great reviews for the book. And I think sales are pretty good. It's hard to tell at this point. But I know it's on the new release table in Barnes & Noble stores. Target's going to be carrying it in January, which is a big deal. Auntie's Books in Spokane has copies in there.